And so we will today be in Joshua, next week, and then we'll move on to some other topics that I think will be of great interest to you. But let's, if we can, get into this and turn with me to Joshua 9. But as an introduction, we see here that now we are talking about the neighboring Gibeonites, and they approach Israel pretending to actually be from a far-off land and that they were sojourners so that they would enter into, and Israel does enter into, a covenant to protect them. And so as a result, their lives are spared, and now they become an ally. And almost instantaneously, Israel now has to come to their rescue when they're surrounded by a band of others. And then they eventually fight a battle against five different kings and kingdoms, in a sense, wipe them out. And the rest of Joshua really is sort of a mop-up operation. So we're going to break this down, as you see in the handout, into two sections. First of all, making bad decisions. And this will be appropriate, I think, for us to learn that sometimes we make some really bad decisions. Maybe you bought a couch, put it on a credit card, and later said, you know, I wish we had gone to this other store because there was a couch that we liked even better, and it was half the price. Maybe you bought a car, and it was a bad decision. But I thought this one was kind of fun. Back in 1977, the executives of 20th Century Fox made a deal with a young filmmaker by the name of George Lucas. In exchange for a mere $20,000, 20th Century Fox agreed to give Lucas full product merchandising rights for all the Star Wars films produced. At the time, the executives didn't know how Star Wars would do as a series. The films are measured by their bottom dollar, and 20th Century Fox was willing to bet that Star Wars wouldn't take off. Little did the executives know that Star Wars would be a massive success, not just in terms of box office, but also in creating a cultural phenomenon. To date, there have been 7 films producing a total of $5.8 billion earned at the box office. But now back to the merchandise. The merchandise revenue alone brought in $3 billion and continues to increase annually. 20th Century Fox lacked the foresight to see that their agreement with Lucas would end up costing them plenty. No matter what bad decision you've made, it's never been that bad, right? But I think it's illustration of that. So turn with me, if you would, to Joshua chapter 9, and we'll see a bad decision that the Israelites made. And in the interest of time, I want to, at the end, get into this complex series of questions, one of those having to do with Joshua's long day. I've been waiting till our amateur astronomer, Parker. Actually, he has so many telescopes. Can we now call him a professional astronomer? You know, but I did not want to do this till we had the astronomer in the house. So we're going to focus some time and attention on that. But in chapter 9, I thought we'd skip down over the first section there and start in verses 3 and following. This is where we see the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai. And then they began to make provisions and took worn-out sacks for their donkeys and wineskins, worn out and torn and mended with worn-out patched sandals on their feet and worn out clothes so that they would look like they were sojourners from a far land. Skip ahead a little bit to then where they ask this, that they might get a covenant. And we see in verse 7, but the men of Israel, they will have none of it. And they say, perhaps you live among us. Then how can we make a covenant with you? God had said that they were to wipe out those who were in the land of Canaan, but they would actually make a covenant with those who were far away. And so they said, we are your servants. But Joshua said, who are you and where did you come from? And here's where the lie comes. From a very distant country, your servants have come because of the name of the Lord your God. And we have heard a report of him and all that he did in Egypt and all that you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan. And so you can begin to see that they're trying to put together this particular ploy to say that we are not actually in the land, but we are from a far land. Well, we'll skip down. Let's go to verse 16 here. Then we see that at the end of 3 days, Israel no longer is really seeking the Lord. They're just seeking their own common sense. And it says, at the end of 3 days, after they had made a covenant with them, they heard that they were their neighbors and that they lived among them. And so now you begin to see some dissension because they had made a covenant with the Lord. The leaders had entered into that covenant. And so as a result, the people began to murmur. We see that in verses 18 and following. So verse 19, but all the leaders said to all the congregation, we have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we may not touch them. I'm going to talk a little bit about what that meant in terms of the covenant. But one more thing, we see that also Joshua takes the time to say in verse 22, why did you deceive us, saying that we are from far from you when you dwell among us? And what we, I think, see here is the whole situation that has unfolded there in chapter 9. And that is, they decided in this particular case, I'd have to say, to walk by sight instead of walking by faith. And as a result, where in other cases they had been willing to consult with the Lord, we see first in their initial defeat in Ai, and now in this situation, instead of seeking the Lord, they did what they thought was best. And sometimes that's how we make bad decisions. You know, we say, well, I think I have a pretty good handle on that. I don't really need to pray about that. I'm pretty sure I've got a pretty good understanding of common sense. And we see, of course, the consequences in their particular case. So, of course, the victories had spread and they were afraid. And so they deceived them into thinking that we're, as we said, sojourners from the land, because they were allowed to actually make covenants with those who were outside of the land. Then we see that, if nothing else, we've got to give them some credit. Credit because they believed in the military reports, and credit also because they knew enough to know about the directives of Israel so that they entered into that particular covenant. And so we see that first they acted with caution, the Israelites did, but eventually sympathy and compassion. And those of us that have traveled in the Middle East, and we were just back, as you heard, from Israel and Greece, I can't tell you the number of times both our guide in Israel and especially our guide in Greece with all the gypsies said, you know, there are going to be people that are going to try to pull on your heartstrings, but they are using that just to manipulate you. You would see those that would have these very nice backpacks that would hide them in the bushes and then pretend to be poor and then go out and eat their sandwich and then come back and pretend to be poor. And sometimes they bring a baby with you. And so sometimes sympathy and compassion, as good as it is, can be manipulated. And in this particular case, we can see how it was. And I think the key verse, if you are marking your Bibles, you might put verse 14 there. Because they what? Did not seek or ask counsel from the Lord. And I think if there's a lesson we can learn vicariously, I believe that even in rabbinical school, there were times perhaps that they taught the Jewish young men and women, here is a lesson to learn from Joshua. There's a lesson from their initial defeat in Ai. There's a lesson here in their covenant with the Gibeonites. And of course, they had a actual visible reminder of that, because the Gibeonites from that point on actually served first in the tabernacle and then in the temple. So the Israelites would see the Gibeonites serving, and it was a reminder of that bad decision that was made by Joshua. Of course, they did the human thing, help those who were poor, but of course, they accept really questionable evidence. And I put down Proverbs 12, verse 19. A lying tongue lasts only a moment, and in this case, it lasts 3 days. And so they had sworn an oath to the Gibeonites by the Lord, and the congregation grumbled. But as I point out, the leaders said, well, we swore to the Lord, so they kept their commitment, which I think is another good principle. When you make a decision, sometimes you have to live with the consequences. You know, this trip that we took to Israel, I got to know one of the individuals a little better. I knew him because he listens to our radio program that is Stockton, California, KYCC, and I met him at other events. But I found out his circumstances, and that is he built this incredible business, and then his bookkeeper embezzled all the funds. And he was just barely able to come to Israel, because he had taken the time, even after that had happened, to go back and pay every single person that they owed, including, he said, I just recently paid off the last of the debts. That was to my fraternity brothers from the University of Pacific. And I just thought about, you know, we as Christians really need to be people of integrity. And here you see, we're going to honor the commitment. And here you have a very good example of that, nevertheless. Now, we see that that commitment, of course, is going to be tested in the very next chapter, because as soon as they say, we're going to make a covenant with you and protect you, now they have to actually protect them. And so, if nothing else, we see that God helped the Israelites honor that commitment. And if you're taking some notes, you might put down 2 Samuel 21, because here is a case where we have, interesting enough, where Saul abandons that commitment. and actually kill some of the Gibeonites. And so as a result, there is a judgment that God brings upon him and Israel before that. So when we think of a covenant, we think of making our commitment. We always think, well, that just lasts for a while. Maybe that lasts till I'm alive. No, that covenant exists to that point in time. And we, of course, even saw a couple of weeks ago when an individual, which we also saw in 2 Samuel, wanted to go back and rebuild Jericho. He lost his first son when he set the foundation, and he lost his youngest son when he built that up. There are consequences, even multi-generations later, to this particular case. But look at verse 21. It says that they became woodcutters and water carriers. And so as a result, interestingly enough, they now have a responsibility. They're not full Israeli citizens, but they are actually involved in the tabernacle. And so as we might even point out, the Israelites did the right thing by keeping their commitment, but they also, of course, had to live with the consequences. First of all, the consequence to them was that they had to bear the burden of defending them. The consequences to the Gibeonites were that they had now to serve in the tabernacle and even later in the temple. And so this would be, in some respects, like I said, a visual reminder every single day to a bad decision. Aren't you glad that some of the bad decisions you've had aren't there still to remind you? Unless, of course, you still have that couch that every time you walk by, you realize, I could have gotten one for half as much, or that car that still you're taking to the shop. But this is a visual reminder for generations of a bad decision that was made back in the book of Joshua. And we also, of course, see that that God's grace extends to them, because, again, if you go to the book of Ezra, he even says that when the Israelites return back from captivity in Babylon, the Gibeonites are still serving there. So you see not only God's faithfulness, but I guess you really see the Gibeonites' faithfulness, that they were still serving in the temple, even when you now come to the rebuilding of the temple and all the rest. And, of course, there is a little bit of a benefit, because since they're serving in the temple, it freed up other individuals to actually serve in military service, in particular now going to what we're going to see in chapter 10. Turn with me again to chapter 10. We'll look just real briefly, since we want to take enough time for some of the application. And we see here that, first of all, we're talking about a battle that takes place with the king of Jerusalem. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Of course, Jerusalem becomes then the capital of Israel. And his name is Adonizedek, which is based on Melchizedek. And this is Adonizedek. So we're going to go back to Melchizedek in just a minute. We see in verse 3, for example, that he is the king of Jerusalem, but he also has now brought these other kings together. And so now we have a five-king allied coalition that is going to come against Israel. And this, in some respects, begins to be a benefit for Joshua, because up until now, he's got to pick off every single one of these cities, and now they all gather together. That's the good news. He can finish them all off at once. The bad news is there are a whole lot of them, and now he's going to have to depend upon God's intervention in order to kill them. And so let's go ahead to verse 11. And here we said, as they now begin to flee, the Lord threw down large stones from heaven on them as far as a particular location known as Azekah, and died. And there were those who died, and matter of fact, more died because of the hailstones than the sons of Israel killed with the sword. Now here it calls hailstones, but I think the better translation is that these were large stones. These are meteorites. Now, when I talk about the long day of Joshua in just a minute, that's going to be really important. So keep that in perspective. But let's go down a little bit further. And now in verse 12, it talks about how the sun stood still at Gibeon and the moon in the valley of Aljalon. And the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation took vengeance upon their enemies. So now we have an additional period of time. Not just a 24-hour day, but what could almost be a 48-hour day. I know some of you trying to get everything done wish you had a 48-hour day. I don't know. I want to get some rest. But here they have that opportunity. Then we can see that the kings begin to escape. They go into the cave. So look down in verse 18. And so Joshua says, okay, they're in the cave. Just roll some stones over the mouth of the cave. And we'll get to them later. And then eventually they pull them out, put their feet on their neck. They kill the kings, and they are finished now with the conquest of southern Canaan. And because they have pretty much destroyed the major military forces from verses 11 to about 18 now, and we're going to go through those pretty quickly next week, we see that the northern conquest is taking place. By the time they bring about this particular military victory, it's pretty much a mop-up operation, and now they're able to actually take the land. So let's, if we can, go see a little bit more of some of that. As you see in your handout, the first point here is march even when you don't want to. And so here they are in the midst of having to, first of all, defend the Gibeonites, but also they bring their forces against the five kings of the southern region who have now banded together. This, of course, as I said, gave him an opportunity because instead of trying to pick off one city after another, he meets the military leaders in a valley and begins to fight on that. The victory, in fact, was going so well that now Joshua needs more time, so he prays for a longer day. It's interesting that it says this is only one time when this actually took place in the scriptures. And if you begin to look around at the ancient Near East, there are four other cultures that have a story about a longer day. Then if you begin to go to India, there's a story there of a longer day. If you go to China, Emmanuel Velikovsky said that there was a story there of a longer day. But if you go the other direction, you can see that there were four or five Indian tribes in North America that had a story of a longer night. Then there's a story of the Aztecs and the Incas that all have a story of a longer night. And there's at least one place in the western part of Africa that has a story of a longer night. Are those just interesting stories, or does that maybe suggest that something like that maybe actually took place? We'll come back to that in just a minute. Well, then, first of all, march, even when you don't feel like marching. Now engage, even when you're afraid. And now Joshua and his troops learned an important lesson that appears again, and that is to press the battle according to God's plan and leave the miracles to them. So they get them on the run, and then now we see that more are killed by these meteorites than are actually killed even by the sword of Joshua. And so at this point now, this army is devastated, and because of that, the kings go and hide themselves in a cave, and so he directs them to just wall them up. And in the midst of this, we see a statement that Joshua makes many times, be strong and courageous, and we see this here in verse 25. He said, do not be afraid or dismayed, be strong and courageous, for thus the Lord will do to all your enemies against whom you fight. And at this point now, if you are not encouraged as a soldier in the army of Joshua, you would have to be. Because you have seen miracles that have taken place crossing the Jordan River, right? You've seen miracles in Jericho. You see another miracle in Ai. And now you see this incredible miracle where more people are killed by meteorites crashing down upon them than actually those who were killed by the sword. And so he says, be strong and courageous. We have taken the southern region of Canaan, and only now do we need to just continue on and take the northern region as well. Finally, pursue when you are tired. Here, this section shows that any serious opposition to Israel in the southern part of Canaan has now been eliminated. So they're now victorious. The major cities have been defeated, and in many cases, all these effective coalitions have been broken up. And so in some respects, you can kind of see two lessons just from these two chapters. Lesson number one is to make sure that you keep commitments that you've made. Of course, maybe another lesson is make sure you don't make bad decisions in the first place, but certainly keep your commitments. And number two, to be persistent when you run into various obstacles. But what I wanted to do is spend the rest of our time, if I can, doing two points of application. And the first, as I referred to it, is The Art of the Deal. We've been hearing a lot about that book, haven't we? Well, this is not about the book, but it is about something that I thought was kind of intriguing. And that is, when we look at what is happening in the Old Testament, it's a very reminiscent of what Jesus spoke about in the New Testament. So turn with me, if you might, to the book of Luke. And in Luke chapter 16, verses 8 and 9, he gives us a parable that I thought would be kind of intriguing to look at. And it has to do with the fact that here, it's a parable of the dishonest manager. And it tells us, first of all, that while that manager was there, the master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And then Jesus goes on to say, and I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into their eternal dwellings. And so the point I want to make is that we learned a little bit about some of the decision-making here, but I think there's a really interesting principle here because Jesus is using an example. And of all the parables, this one is kind of a head-scratcher because it seems like at first Jesus is saying, well, you really need to be a shrewd businessman. You really need to be very wise. You might even need to be sort of cunning. And that says, well, that doesn't sound like it's Christian, but the point I think he's trying to make here is that if anything, when we make decisions, whatever those decisions are, we need to be fairly shrewd. And we see that this is one place where Joshua really fell down. He should have asked additional questions. He should have sought the Lord. He should have been asking a lot of those questions. And here we can see at least two principles. First, the rich man commends the manager's shrewdness with his stewardship. And notice what Jesus said. Sometimes the people of the world are more shrewd than Christians. You ever heard the phrase, those that are like serpents and those who are like doves? Remember that phrase? And I think what it's implying here is that if anything, we should be really asking good questions. We should really be making good decisions. And if anything, we should make sure that we don't use our possessions in a way that is frivolous or naive, but using them in a more effective way. And that's our second principle. Worldly possessions can be used to prepare for eternity. You know, if you think about it, a shrewd businessman or businesswoman might actually be willing to forego current consumption. That's what we talk about sometimes in economics. They're willing to live a very frugal lifestyle in order to invest in future profits. I just use the example of George Lucas. But if you go back and look at some of those individuals that have been successful in the high-tech industry, some of them were surviving on peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and now they're multi-billionaires. And I think what Jesus is saying is, if we see in the world individuals that are willing to invest to get future profits, shouldn't we as Christians be willing to invest our worldly resources? And by that, he might mean money. He might be talent. It could be your time, your talent, or your treasure. We should be willing to invest because we're looking at, indeed, how that would actually impact for eternity. And I think Jesus is using this because perhaps he did not feel the disciples, or certainly the Pharisees, were handling their resources properly. And I think the implication there is whether we're making good or bad decisions, whether we're using wise investments in our life, how are we really investing our life? And so again, I think we can learn a vicarious lesson that Joshua made a bad decision. Let's make sure that over the next couple of weeks, we don't make similar bad decisions that stand around and exist for many years and in a sense are just a reminder of the unwillingness to invest our time, our talent, and our treasure for the Lord. Well, let's get to the second one because this is the one that is the most difficult passage in the Bible. You don't think so? When you had the Scopes trial, you had Clarence Darrow cross-examine William Jennings Bryant. In the midst of that debate about creation and evolution, the case that he brought before William Jennings Bryant was the case of the sun stopping on the long day of Joshua. How could any reasonable person believe that all of a sudden you have the earth stop and we have, instead of a 24-hour day, you have a 48-hour day? And so you can see some of the questions that people have always had about this so-called long day of Joshua. Well, there's some possible interpretations. I put a few on the screen. The first, which is the one that Clarence Darrow used to make fun of William Jennings Bryan, is, well, Mr. Bryan, do you think that the earth stopped? He said, sure, that's what the Bible says. Well, if the earth stopped its rotation, recognize the earth is rotating at 1,100 miles per hour, at least at the equator. Can you imagine what would happen if you were to stop it? Everything would go flying, wouldn't it? As a matter of fact, anything that is not actually rooted in the bedrock would leave, you know, not just people, but everything. I mean, boom. You can imagine if you were flying a jet and you run into a jet may be traveling at half that speed, but it hits a mountain, and what happens? Everything goes forward, you know. So you can see that that doesn't make very good sense. Some have said, well, maybe God slowed the rotation of the earth a little bit. Well, even so, the slowing down, that doesn't seem to work very well scientifically. So that's at least one theoretical option, but not many people land on that. The second is that maybe there was some kind of refraction of light that produced more light so the battle could begin, but then that would give more light in one area, but it still wouldn't answer the question of the fact that we have some where we have a long day and some we have a long night. So some others have suggested maybe this was just a special sign. You know, maybe God just specifically put signs and made the sun look like it was up in the heavens or in the moon. And that's a possibility. And then the other, and the one that I think more people tend to land on, is simply this. Maybe it was just figurative language. And that after all, we see that maybe it was a way of simply saying that the sun and moon joined into the battle. And the reason they say that is if you look at the book of Judges, it says that the sun and moon fight for Israel, and that happened in Deborah's day. Does we really mean the sun and moon came down and fought? No. And in Habakkuk, it talks about the sun and moon stand amazed at what was happening. So maybe it's figurative language. Do any of those really answer your question? Not too well. I mean, that's the difficulty I think Christians throughout the centuries have had about the long day of Joshua. So in the time remaining, I want to see if we can maybe find a scientific answer. And in order to do that, first of all, let's go back to what the text itself says. The first thing is that we're talking about what's called the Battle of Beth Horon, and this was fought against Adonai Zedek. That sounds a lot like Melchizedek. Well, that is, because Melchizedek was the king of what? Salem, which later came to be known as Jerusalem, because you have the Jebusites there. So you have Jebus. It came by that time to be known as Jebus. And then, of course, that's where the word Jerusalem comes from. Jebusalem became Jerusalem. So they fight against this particular individual in Jerusalem. Now, it also says that they were defeated, probably a better translation, by stones of fire from heaven. Well, that doesn't sound like hailstones. That sounds like what? Meteorites. So let's start there. The sun is extended in some way. The day is extended. And it also says the sun and the moon are extended so that he can finish the operation, and it's a mop-up. So that's what the text says. Now, for a few minutes, what I want to do is look at what seemingly are isolated events that have no relationship to the book of Joshua and pull them all together to see if we have an answer. The first is if you go and look at all the ancient calendars of the world, I can identify 14 different ancient calendars of the world. They all had a 360-day year. Matter of fact, Israel used to have a 360-day year. Now, you say, how did they make that work? Well, they used to add in some extra hours during the feast to make it work out. But something very interesting. In 701 B.C., you notice that all the ancient calendars now have a 365-day year. What's that all about? Matter of fact, Rome had a 365-and-a-quarter-day year. But at one time, we had 360-day years. And then, all of a sudden, in about the 7th century B.C., you have 365-day years. We also see that almost all the ancient civilizations were terrified by the planet Mars. Anybody do martial arts? You know, that's where the word martial arts comes from. Mars, martial arts. Interestingly enough. And Mars was the god of war. But they were terrified by the planet Mars. Well, if you've ever been out there doing astronomy with Parker, you know that with a telescope you can see it. Otherwise, it looks like another star. What's that all about? And some scientists now believe that Mars was much closer in what's called a resonant orbit with Earth than it is today. So again, let's look at that for just a minute. Some are saying that Earth at that time had a 360-day orbit, and that Mars had a 720-day orbit, but these were elliptical orbits where they passed by each other. And so there were times when Mars was much closer to Earth, and those passbys would take place about every 108 years. And this is a phenomenon that people have now noticed, that because of that, there are various phenomena that actually correlate with those passbys. And by doing that, each time it comes by, there is an energy transferred in one direction, energy transferred from Mars to Earth, the other time from Earth to Mars, and eventually formed in the orbit we find today. If you want to see this in a diagram, let me put the diagram up there for just a minute. And what you have is Mars, and this is highly diagrammatic, but I think it gives you a little bit of an idea of the fact that at one time you had what is called a resonant orbit. Now, what do I mean by resonant? Anybody's ever taken music, you know that if you have a tuning fork and you do one, you put another tuning fork, and you know, they will get the same pitch. And so those orbits are resonant. I know it's getting a little scientific, but believe me, there's a lot more science behind this. But as Mars is coming across, it will actually get very close to Earth at two different times, usually in the spring and the fall. And as a result, that may be, as many people believe, an explanation for what we're going to look at in just a minute. There's a reason to believe that Mars was much closer, and the reason goes all the way back to Gulliver's Travels. Remember when you read Gulliver's Travels in grade school or maybe in high school? Well, in Gulliver's Travels, there's a story that Jonathan Swift has of them going, and in the third part there, they go to the island of Laputa. Well, when they go to the island of Laputa, it turns out that it gives a perfectly accurate description of the two moons around Mars. Now, as a matter of fact, before I get to the description, let me just point out that when Jonathan Swift was alive, the best-known astronomer at the time by the name of Herschel, he'd only been able to discover the planet Uranus, and actually did see the moons of Uranus, but the moons of Mars were not seen by an astronomer until 1877. As you're going to see in just a minute, he describes these two moons on Mars 151 years before any astronomer ever seen it. And the theory is that he'd actually taken this from eyewitness accounts of those who'd actually seen those particular moons. It says they were likewise discovered two lesser moons which revolve around Mars, which are the innermost is distant from the center of the primary planet, approximately 3 of its diameters, and the outermost 5. The former revolves in a space of 10 hours, the latter in 21 and a half. It gives exactly the size, the space, and the orbit of those two moons 151 years before anybody even knew that they existed. It goes on. I won't go into all the details, but if you read it through here, it's a perfect, certainly 18th century, 19th century, frankly, it's a perfect 21st century description of two moons that nobody had ever seen. And the theory is that, indeed, neither Jonathan Swift nor Herschel knew about these, but most likely they drew upon ancient accounts to actually color this political satire, and so as a result they were drawing from eyewitness accounts of when Mars actually was much closer to Earth and they could see those two particular moons. And the reason for that is Mars would be only about 70,000 miles away, so Mars would be 50 times larger than the moon. Can you imagine what it must be like to look in the sky and see a planet that large? Well, if indeed that's the case, then let's go back to our long day, because some people have actually made the argument then that if indeed that was the case, it would actually have created earthquakes and land tides. You know, when we have our moon go by, we have water tides, right? We have ocean tides. We also have land tides, just that we don't feel them because they only go up an inch. But you imagine a planet getting that close to us, you'd have land tides and earthquakes and all of the rest. This would certainly cause some kind of polar shift, and as a result could have lengthened the day. But also, as they ran the models on this simulation, it also would have actually had meteorites hitting the Earth at about 300,000 miles an hour. or 30,000 miles an hour, excuse me, I slipped a decimal point, but still pretty fast. And interestingly enough, but here's the miracle. It only hits what? It only hits the enemies. Now, again, if you'd like to see a little bit more, I've got a video here just where it explains a little bit more, because I know I went through that fairly quickly, but it's at least a possibility to begin to think about how this might be answered from a scientific point of view.
Then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, "Sun stand still over Gibeon, and moon in the valley of Ajalon." So the sun stood still and the moon stopped, till the people had revenge upon their enemies. So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. This long day event recorded in Joshua 10 is often protested due to the serious complications of suspending the earth's rotation. However, the Bible does not necessarily claim that the earth's rotation was suspended. In fact, according to scientific experts, suspension of the earth's spin is not even necessary for this event to take place. A change in precession could also explain this event. Studies have shown that the orbits of planets can influence each other and actually be in orbital resonance with each other. A couple of clues lead us to believe that the Earth and Mars were once in orbital resonance. One clue is the ancient calendars. History tells us that the ancient calendars were once based on 360-day years, but were all changed after 701 BC for reasons unexplained. The Romans, in fact, added 5 1/4 days to their calendar. If Earth and Mars were once in orbital resonance, then their orbital periods would have been different. Modeling this and plugging in a 360-day year for Earth and a 720-day year for Mars shows near passbys occurring every 108 years, with energy being exchanged each time. Amazingly, this model explains at least 7 catastrophic events in history. According to this model, the Earth originally did have a 360-day year, but changed to a 365-day year in 701 BC due to a final energy transfer with Mars. This could be responsible for the long day event. A second clue lies in the discovery date of the 2 moons of Mars called Phobos and Deimos. Officially, these moons were discovered in 1877 by Asaph Hall. Interestingly, however, 151 years earlier, Irish author Jonathan Swift writes about the 2 moons of Mars in his famous work called Gulliver's Travels. It is in the 3rd voyage of Gulliver's Travels called Voyage to Laputa, where Gulliver visits an island in the sky called Laputa. Here the astronomers are described as having knowledge not only of the 2 moons of Mars, but also about their orbital distances and periods. Amazingly, the accuracy is within 20%. How could Swift have had this knowledge 151 years before the discovery of Phobos and Deimos? Was it simply a lucky guess? The fact that he got the number of moons correct and that his numbers were within 20% accuracy is troubling. Could Swift have known about Phobos and Deimos? This also is highly unlikely, since he knew astronomers like Herschel. If the astronomy world did not know about the moons of Mars, then neither would he. This leads us to believe that Swift probably drew from legends and folklore. He probably used these to add depth and richness to his story. What Swift probably did not realize, however, was that he was drawing from eyewitness accounts. But how could the ancients have known about the moons of Mars? If Earth and Mars were in orbital resonance in ancient times, then at closest approach, Mars would have only been 70,000 miles away. At this distance, Mars would have appeared 50 times the size of our own moon, making the moons of Mars clearly visible. History tells us that the ancient peoples were very frightened of Mars. Understandable if it were much closer. Truthfully, God could have easily used any method he wanted to lengthen the day. Suspending the Earth's rotation is not a hard feat for the Almighty, nor is creating the celestial bodies with preordained purposes.
Well, nothing else, it's just another way of possibly explaining this idea of the long day. You know, it could be just figurative. God could have certainly stopped all sorts of orbital mechanics, but I think it's kind of intriguing that some are working on that potential theory to explain the interesting phenomenon. You can go onto YouTube and see that some have actually documented where you have seen, interestingly enough, especially in the Western Hemisphere, seen all sorts of studies and various stories and legends of a long night. And then when you go to the Middle East and India, stories of a long day. Are those all just coincidence? I think, again, suggests that maybe something indeed took place. But if nothing else, I think it just once again reaffirms our conviction that if we continue to do investigation, maybe we'll find answers to what I think is one of the most troubling of all questions in the Old Testament, and that is, what about this long day of Joshua? And I wanted to make sure I did this while we had our resident astronomer here today. Parker?